You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to episode 367 of Dots, Lines, and Destinations. I'm Stephen Seagraves, joined this week by Seth Miller and a special guest, Mr. Jason Rabinowitz of AvTalk,
Flight Radio
24's podcast. Hey, Jason, how are you?
How's it going? Happy to be back.
Yeah, good. It's been a while.
Yeah, because see, normally Jason's on the episodes when he and I are traveling.
Yeah, remember that happening. When we used to like have events to go to and things to cover and fun things to talk about?
There's still sort of fun things to talk about, at least.
Yeah, but I won't go to them.
There's that. There is that. So I guess that means you're not going to the Northern Pacific.
No. Well, I mean, they canceled half of the event, and they canceled the half of the event I was interested in going to. So
there is that.
I'm not going out of my way for that.
Fair point.
Which half of the event was that?
Actually flying on the plane.
Oh, they were actually going to like have a
flight? The original plan was to do a media flight after the unveiling from San Bernardino up to Anchorage.
And that would have my full attention. But once you get rid of that, it's really just, you know, a 3-day trip to San Bernardino, which I don't need right now.
To take some photos of an airplane interior?
Yeah. Call me when the thing's ready.
Call me when you're flying that flight.
Exactly. I don't even think the interior is ready. Didn't they say they were going to do that work later on? And now I think it's just the livery reveal.
I thought they said they were going to let us on board, so we'll see.
They told you they were going to let you on board. They didn't tell you there'd be anything inside the plane.
To be fair, an empty 757 would be pretty cool.
That would be pretty nice. Yeah, that's true.
Way better than the old U.S. Airways seats.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, man. So, I mean, is I guess the big news, or there's a bunch of big news, but the big news this week was the Allegiant 737 MAX announcement. And this is Allegiant's order for a bunch of MAXs.
50.
50 plus 50 options.
50 options, yeah. But yeah, 50 firm, deliveries starting in 2023 and finished by 2025 for the initial tranche.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's pretty quick.
And there's a couple things that that timeline, I think, yields. One is that's why they chose the MAX.
Well, it's not even yield. It's they outright said that in one of their SEC filings. They straight up said, we're ordering these because we can, you know,
get delivery slots. Yeah. But, I mean, so that is a huge part of it. One could easily surmise like, hey, but you also could have probably found some A320s somewhere coming off a lease or, you know, that were available, right? But maybe not.
Probably not 50.
That's fair. No, I mean, they have found 10 or 12 here and there over the last couple of years. So
they did say they're going to keep doing that.
Right. So that's the other part of this that's so crazy is they're not going to a full switch. They're going to a mixed fleet. And I think Maury Gallagher's comments about that in the investor briefing were pretty funny. Something to the effect of like, no, we know that we're doing that. We know how to spell airplane. It's fine. Like, we got some pretty smart people who work here who all know how to spell airplane. We'll be okay, I think, was more or less his exact quote. So,
I mean, they are an airline that has historically at times had split fleets before. When they converted over from the old MD-80s to A320s, they had split fleets. At some point, they had 757. So they're not a complete newcomer to this. But in this case, it is going to be way more dramatic or way more larger scale than
larger scale, and they're going to keep the split fleet, it seems like, for at least a while.
Yeah, they put out another one of the charts in the SEC filing, and they're at some point going to start retiring some of the very older A320s and maybe 2025. But yeah, those Airbus they have are going to stay in the fleet for a long time because some of them, remember, they actually took some directly from Airbus 13 years ago.
13 brand new, and then a bunch of leases. But you know, it was also interesting to me to see in the filing the mention of they wanted the higher fuel efficiency was one of their excuses, which, again, going back to the history of this airline of, like, buying beat-to-hell MD-80s and flying them until they fell apart, essentially. Not quite, but close. You know, to talk about fuel efficiency all of a sudden, like, I guess the difference is that fuel costs money now, whereas, you know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, it was too cheap to care. I don't know. I mean, it is, right? Jet A is costs a lot more now, but...
Yeah.
That was an interesting part of it as well. I don't know. The thing that's going to be interesting to me is to see how they split up the operations. One of the things that's unique about Allegiant is they basically have like 30 or 40 bases all over the country. And they put a couple planes in a base and some pilots and flight attendants and whatever else and mechanics and all that work. But any given base could be either Airbus or Boeing is the way I see it, right? They'll pick whichever ones need which size planes and say, okay, you get this, you get that, you get this, you get that. And so, yes, it's not like a United where they need every hub to have full staffing for everything. if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Do you think that they are, how do you think they approach that? Is it by demand or is it by fuel efficiency, a mix of both? Like, what are they looking at when they look at this kind of stuff?
I got to assume it's mostly seat count.
Mm.
Right, so
especially since they ordered the smallest variant of the Max, but also the currently the highest capacity version, I guess, short of the 10 with the -8-200 Ryanair Signature Edition,
which bizarrely actually has a max seat count of 210, I think.
Yeah, it's weird
because you know we counted to 200 and then someone's like,
it with that many passengers.
Right, we counted to 200 and like, oh, we're gonna fit a few more in, but we like the 200 for the marketing.
You
so
don't
just keep
really
that.
Need three lavs on that plane, right?
Yeah. Or seatbelts for anybody. It'll be fine. Just wedge them in and then they're stuck there. You know.
It'll be fine.
Now, it is interesting that, yes, they chose the largest. And so that was, I'm sure, one of the challenges. And this goes back to my comment about couldn't they just pick up sort of more Airbus. They almost certainly can't get 321s. If they get anything, it'd be 319s or 320s because those are in lower demand.
Yeah.
So if they want the higher seating capacity, you either need the 8200 or a 321, which now is a 321neo, and like the whole world wants 321neos fresh off the line. So it's no surprise there that Airbus doesn't have capacity to produce those. And then the Dash 7 is like, what, 142 seats?
Give or take.
They're just under 150. Which Southwest is a big customer for, so fine. There, it's not going to be just Allegiant flying them. They also, haven't been certified yet. Supposedly early this year, but it's going to be super interesting to see that come to fruition. Because yes, we're right. Even at its highest, as packed as it can get, it's a relatively low density plane. It sort of replaces the 319s that Allegiant has, and then Allegiant does like 183, 186 on its 320s, right?
Something
like that, Jason.
Pretty much at the max.
Yeah, and then 200. So then they'll have like a 140. A 180 and a 200 seat plane. Hmm. But if they want to mix and match, they can put 140s and 200s at the same base.
Hmm.
Right? Because they'll have the same pilots and crew and everything.
Yeah, the whole thing's interesting. They're going to have to work these aircraft many, many hours to make up for the cost of actually buying a new aircraft. But who knows what they actually paid for these things? Nobody would doubt that they got an absolute screaming deal on these.
So one of the interesting things, right? In terms of total CapEx and your allusion to you have to fly the plane a certain amount to be able to generate enough revenue to pay off sort of the monthly mortgage, right? Or justify the initial CapEx. One of the interesting things I saw about this deal potentially was the idea of buying them because they have capital to do so and then initiating a sale-leaseback transaction where they basically sell it to the leasing company and then lease it. Right? So they get the leasing company eventually pays them the cash up front and then they get cash infusion and then they pay out whatever they want month to month. Depending on how much they paid and how well they did negotiating with Boeing versus how much a leasing company would have paid for similar early delivery slots, and if Allegiant wants to have the out at the end of 10 years, it was suggested that they actually might make money on the deal by buying them cheaper, selling them to a leasing company that knows that Allegiant will pay them whatever rate for 10 years, and then have these planes ready to place elsewhere 10 years from now. I'm not entirely sure I buy it, but it was an interesting sort of.
Yeah, it's a theory, for sure.
It's an interesting theory, right? Like, five-dimensional chess at that point, but it was an interesting concept of how it would come together.
Yeah, there was also something interesting on the SEC document they put out about they were considering the A220 as well, I think the 300, mm-hmm. and they said they could get delivery of them in the near term, but they had a big red X next to parts availability, which I didn't think was a problem for the A220 family, or I hadn't heard of that being a problem, but that really stuck out to me.
So there was a couple things about that. One is they could get them, but they were worried that production rates were too low to be able to get enough quickly enough. So I don't know if that was right. I mean, like, it's sort of the Breeze model. If, like, Breeze is taking half the A220s produced in the U.S. right now, I think, right? Or
yeah, or stashing them away somewhere before they put them in service.
In theory, right? Like, they're taking one a month, and I think, is Airbus up to four there yet?
Don't know.
But right, like, or maybe it was four A220s, A320s and two A220s, but it's like the production pace for the 220 is relatively slow. So if you wanted 10 in a year, you would have a hard time securing that much, again, similar to the 320neo for a couple years out yet. I do wonder if the parts thing is there aren't parts available or there aren't enough parts stashed all over the world or all over the country in Allegiant's case that they can't have access to them. Right? Like, how many different places can you find the spares?
Right, right.
So, and especially because Allegiant has, like we said earlier, so many different bases where they would potentially need them. How would you keep enough distributed versus a Delta that just keeps them all in Atlanta and Detroit and whatever, like at the big hubs, and then can easily get a part to one of its non-hub destinations on one of the other planes, is a theory. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But the other thing about the number of hours flying required that I think will be interesting to see is think about the other crazy thing that Allegiant has done in recent weeks, which is announcing the Viva Airbus joint venture plan with the Mexican airline. And one of the big things they mentioned is that Saturday is Viva Airbus's busiest day. And Saturday is basically a rest day for Allegiant. So if the deal goes through, imagine seeing a bunch of the MAX 8200s all of a sudden flying to Cancun and Puerto Vallarta every Sunday or every Saturday.
Well, that'd be interesting.
Yeah. So
sorry, I'm just distracted. I just was sent a link to the rarest of rare accidents where a train crashed into a plane in California. caught my attention.
Tell us more.
It looks like a Cessna 172H. Gently crashed outside of Whitman Airport, outside of L.A., I guess, right onto the Metrolinx tracks. And they didn't stop, and they were going fast. And the Cessna 172 is not in one piece anymore, and shrapnel kind of went everywhere, but it looks like everyone's okay.
Did the pilot get out in time?
unclear, but a lot of people were running away from the aircraft at the time. But that's not your typical kind of air accident. Crashes and then demolished by a train.
Imagine the pilot's like, yes, I got it down. We're all safe. Oh, crap.
And in L.A., of all places, getting hit by public transportation in L.A., a train, nonetheless? Come on. What are the odds?
There just aren't enough of those for it to be a reasonable risk profile.
Wow.
All
right,
well,
sorry. Back to the script.
So there was a group of Canadian influencers. I use influencers lightly, but there was
derogatorily.
Derogatorily. That's a good way to put it.
I'm not sure that's a word, but we'll use it anyways.
That was on a flight to Cancun. A couple of flights, I think, on Sunwing, was it?
Yeah, they chartered a Sunwing plane
and were just complete jerks.
Did not obey any of the rules.
Yes. And they now might be stuck in Cancun.
Are they still down there? I haven't paid attention to the story in a couple days, but are they actually still all down there?
I think so.
Version of the story I saw was they did the fatal flaw, which is after you got away with something, you know, posting it on the internet to prove how cool you are. And it got made the rounds of, you know, various media and government organizations. Sunwing was like, yeah, we canceled their return charter flight. The government was like, yeah, we might arrest them when they get back. And then I think they were shopping around. One or two other airlines may have said, no, we're not going to charter. We won't let them charter a flight with us either.
I think WestJet and Air Canada both said screw off.
Yeah, I mean, I would imagine Swoop would say the same thing since they're part of WestJet, right?
Yep.
Yes.
So maybe Flyer or Fleer or whoever wanted that. But maybe they're not in business yet. There's one that's supposed to be starting soon. Canada Atlantic, maybe? They got a 320 that they just got. Maybe they'll be in business in a couple weeks. It's unclear if these people are going to have to buy commercial tickets or... Because, like, in theory, that's possible.
Yeah.
And you could even connect via the United States, I suppose. But
yeah, Fly American. They don't ban anyone.
True facts. You know, it's... Yeah, a whole bunch of idiots.
At least they were nice enough to publish videos very detailed of their crimes or indiscretions. I guess it makes it really easy to identify people who don't deserve the privilege of flying.
Yeah. I love it. I love it.
Shade and Freda. Anyway, sorry.
we've talked a little bit about 5G. There's been an update.
So when last we spoke, we were on the cusp of we'll say a breakdown, I think, in some ways. There was a lot of disagreement, and the FCC and the FAA were still fighting. And in sort of the 11th hour, they came to an agreement last week to delay another 2 weeks and work out a framework of 50 airports that will get an increased buffer zone, I guess.
Okay.
But that the 5G mid-band towers are going to come online for most of the country. And I don't know, I think one of the interesting things to me was the comment about there was a debate of, you know, someone said, oh, well, under this new plan, only the last 20 seconds of flight would be protected. Because that's how close you would be to the airport to be within one of the exclusion or protection zones that would either have 5G off or at a reduced power or whatever.
Yeah.
The mid-band. And I was like, and there's an interesting response to that, which is, Okay, but the whole point of the radio altimeter is for making those last 20 seconds work, right? Like, isn't that when you actually need it? Not like if I'm flying 30,000 feet over the Grand Canyon, I don't care if there's radio altimeter interference.
Yeah, I think the radio altimeter works up to what, like 2,200 or 2,500 feet or something along those lines, which is definitely to be way outside of first 20 seconds or the last or first 20 seconds, I guess. But these exclusion zones, I guess it's kind of a riff on what we also saw in Canada. They did the same thing middle or late last year where they put these not even buffer zones, but exclusion zones that extended out from the runways quite out a distance. It seems like a take on that, what we're doing here, but only in the 50 airports they selected. There are some odd ones missing, like Boston. Logan.
Yeah, I'm super happy about that.
Yeah, but it's not the entire country. It's like 51 economic zones or something like that. So it doesn't apply everywhere. But where it does, it's only 50 airports in that area. But I'm ready for this debate to be over so my phone can go faster.
I
do wonder a little if Boston's excluded because so much of it, so much of the approach path is over water.
Yeah. That's a good point. I am very interested to see how this ends up being finalized, because if you go the Canada approach, the exclusion zones and the reduced power zones, they go quite a distance. And major U.S. airports, they're quite close to cities in some cases. So if you're looking at LaGuardia, it's going to be this huge chunk of Queens down into Brooklyn and upper Manhattan where they wouldn't be able to turn on those radios, which is, I don't know, problematic. But also planes presumably crashing in fire and death, if you would listen to the aviation industry right now, is also not good.
Yeah. And this is the other thing, the sort of other problem I have with it is the sort of posturing of pilots right now vis-a-vis ALPA and their statements saying, like, we're not going to take your word for it. We only fly when we know it's safe. And like, okay, but which science are you looking at for that? And also, why are so many of you against getting vaccinated? But more to the point, which science are you who are you trusting for the science to say it's safe, if not the company or the government bodies that regulate the frequencies? So it's a little weird for me to see like some of that conversation and figure out who is really making these decisions.
Mm. So I don't know. At the end of the day, it seems like the airline industry wants somebody to pay for better altimeters, and nobody has listened yet. But maybe if they yell very, very loudly, someone will do it.
No, I mean maybe that's sort of was the airline industry's approach to the RNAV stuff too, right?
Yeah.
The precise approach is in the upgraded avionics necessary to do sort of glides instead of step downs.
Yeah,
the airline said we're not going to pay for that. If you guys want us to use it and save all that fuel, then you should pay for it also. And thus far, the airlines are sort of winning on that?
Sort of. At the last minute. The last minute.
Yeah. So.
Oh, boy. Let's talk a little bit about New York City subway news. So, hey. Last R32, Jason. What is this?
Yeah. The last run of the Brightliners, for real this time. They were a subway car introduced by the MTA's predecessor, New York City Transit, in 1964, I believe, for the 1964 World's Fair. They were pretty legendary. They were the first all stainless steel car, which is why they were called the Brightliners. And they were just kind of legendarily known as being a tank in the same way kind of like an MD-80 was, that they just kept on going and going. But today, as of about an hour ago, they are officially retired for real this time. And so, I went on one of the final runs today. It was a lot of fun.
These are the ones that looked like corrugated exteriors, right?
Yes, exactly. Okay. They had the corrugated steel kind of exterior. They were in service most recently on the A and C and maybe the J and Z lines up until COVID began in April 2020. They were rumored to be retired, and they were kind of sidelined because they just didn't need them for the reduced demand. But they were actually pulled back into service, I think it was June of that year, because the newest set of trains that they had delivered broke and were pulled off the off the rails. So they pulled these 50-year-old R32s back in service for a few weeks, and they retired again. And the last few weekends, the New York Transit Museum has put them back in service on a few historical runs. And today was the last of the last, and it was a nice time.
Yeah, I remember riding those a ton because of they ran on the C and the E. The sea and the, which is my station basically out of 14th Street and 8th Avenue when I lived there.
Yeah. So. A lot of my trips out to JFK were on these recently, and they were old and creaky and not great, but it always knew I was slightly closer to home when this rattled up to Howard Beach.
They were also a little wider on the inside, or at least felt that way, right?
Yeah. The trains on the letter lines are noticeably wider than the cars on the numbered lines.
Yeah. Yeah. I always found that fascinating, but I guess because they were built at different times. And,
yeah,
they were competing. They were competing companies, weren't they?
Yeah. What is now
IRT and
There was the IRT, the BMD, and the IND, and they were three competing lines. And of course, they didn't want the possibility of a merger, so they purposely made their track stations and trains different widths so that one couldn't gobble up the other and co-mingle trains. And history happened, and it happened anyway. And now we have basically two completely incompatible systems working kind of as one. But the R32s did feel roomier because they had the longitudinal seating that was just along the edges, and they do look much wider than the modern equipment.
Yeah.
It's funny, one thing you mentioned that they're stainless, and I hadn't considered it, but a lot of subway cars had a second life as artificial reefs.
Yeah,
And the stainless would let that last a lot longer, wouldn't it?
Yeah, they did a big batch of that in the late 2000s where they took a bunch of R32s and dumped them out in the Atlantic somewhere to make an artificial reef. I don't know if they're doing that with these. I know they're converting some of them to work trains, but yeah, and they had a nice exhibit on that at the Transit Museum a few years ago. The Redbirds, I think, also some of them went to the bottom of the Atlantic, but yeah, somewhere out there, there's a big pile of old subway trains with fish inside them.
Glorious.
What else we got?
More train stuff.
Oh yeah, more train stuff. So there's also been an announcement that there's a new line that's rumored. Becoming a new line. Yeah, it's an old line becoming a new line, that this is actually going to happen.
I mean,
skeptical.
this line's been floated around for decades and decades. So what used to be called the Triborough RX or something like that has been reduced to the Interborough Express. So instead of three boroughs, we're now down to two. But there's an existing freight rail line that goes over the Hellgate Bridge, which was what Amtrak uses to go between New York and Boston, down through Queens, through like Middle Village, and then south towards south towards the center of Brooklyn, and then cuts over all the way west over to Sunset Park. And right now it's just freight. It is an active freight line, but it's kind of this perfect circumferential line that actually connects Queens and Brooklyn, which there really isn't any north-south connectivity except the G train, and we don't like to talk about the G train. But it's interesting in that the proposal has been around for decades, but it seemingly came out of nowhere from the governor's State of the State address just a couple days ago. So they're going to do a feasibility study to see if they can do it, or an environmental study, and I'm sure they'll come back with some astronomically high estimation of what it will cost, and then they probably won't do it. But at least they're talking about it, which is progress.
And this would be something that's like up on elevated or is it underground, or how?
So most of it is at grade level, or actually I think in an open cut, so below grade. Okay. Some of it in the very northern end by the Hellgate Bridge or in Astoria is elevated as it approaches the Hellgate Bridge, but I think they're cutting this proposal short to Jackson Heights, where I think it's still either at grade or below grade. So none of it actually should be elevated, but the entire thing is grade separated. I don't think there are any railroad crossings. Mm. So it's really interesting in that it's right there. It's been there for over a century. I think there was passenger service on it a long, long, long time ago, but these days it's all just freight with some of our number one exports in New York, which is trash.
Oh, Jason, you're so positive. I love it.
No, seriously.
It's true.
New York's number one rail export is trash. It's got to get out of the city somehow.
Yeah. I mean, it's better on rail, I guess.
Sure.
It is. You do want to move like consistent destination cargo on rail as opposed to trucks or ships.
Agreed. Let's talk about Ryanair. They're leaving Frankfurt. To be honest, I didn't even know that they were there, but
they weren't there long.
No. And they're retreating back to their other Frankfurt. Han, right? Yeah. Which is they had to win a lawsuit to be able to call it Frankfurt because it's so far away. Yeah, I mean, this is in the, you know, long and storied history of airlines fighting with Frankfurt Fraport Airport Authority because it's too expensive to operate there. I guess Ryanair got some concessions, and Fraport was building that whole new LCC terminal on the other side of the field, the south side, on the other side of the runways, that whole new terminal for all the low-cost carriers. And part of that was because Ryanair was there. And Ryanair has now decided, you know what, it's actually kind of expensive to operate here, which I'm interpreting as Fraport held to its, hey, we'll give you, you know, landing fees for free for 2 years, and then, you know, you got to make your own money. And Ryanair really doesn't like those relationships.
Did Ryanair start Frankfurt services during COVID or just before it?
I have to think just before.
Yeah, so maybe this was just all bad timing?
Could be. I mean, obviously, you know, with everything is bad timing at this point in Europe, even for the aviation industry more than the U.S. But I'm trying to remember, there was a fun Follow Me sign, like the Follow Me car meme sort of story, Twitter idiocy between the two airlines. So that we could, if I could find that, would be a good dating of it. But I don't know. Yeah, it has been definitely a little while, so we'll see.
Do you think it's partially just because Frankfurt, it's not as cheap as Han? I mean, Han, the beauty of Han is that it's cheap.
It's got to be 100%.
Yeah, I mean, why else would you operate, you know, 60 miles away?
So. Well, they also had a pilot base there, right?
At Han or at Frankfurt?
I thought it was at Frankfurt, or am I making that up?
I don't remember.
Huh. We make things up all the time on the show, Jason. That's okay. True.
Who's going to hold us accountable?
yeah. 2017, maybe they launched it?
Oh, wow. That's longer than I thought.
2019? Yeah. I don't know. I'll remember when I'm just looking, and when I see Frankfurt, who the heck knows if it's actually real Frankfurt or Han in their publicity. they definitely were flying there in 2019.
Okay.
So, anyway, yeah, it's... I am not that surprised to see the shift, given that I historically, Ryanair does a very aggressive job of negotiating those reduced landing fees and whatever concessions, and then when they don't get it, or, you know, when it's time for those to go away, they get they're willing to walk away.
Or maybe their math just made sense in the before times when every flight could go out with 186 passengers. These days just isn't going to happen.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't know. We will...
We'll see. ITA's investment suitors. So this is the Italian airline.
Alitalia's new. Yeah. Whatever.
I can't use the word Alitalia. I feel dirty. and it looks like Delta, Air France, and KLM are looking at it, and so is Lufthansa. Is there any updates?
Well, I think the long version of this, or the slightly more expanded version of this, is long, when ITA sort of recapitalized and reestablished itself, it made clear that it was looking for outside investors to help bring in money and expertise. And even when Alitalia was trying to sell, the suitors were basically Delta plus Air France KLM and some combination, or Lufthansa Group. And that was sort of, none of that happened. They were happy to let the company go out of business and sort of let the Italian government reset most of the funds. And then when that happened late last year, there was still the discussion about, would either of these invest in the airline? And I think ultimately the decision, you know, no decision was made, but there was a lot of back and forth. And now the amusing part is that apparently Lufthansa Group is saying it might buy in just to keep Air France KLM and Delta from getting it.
I guess that ad they published a couple months ago worked.
It's one of the more bizarre justifications for investing, you know, many millions of euros in an airline. But, I mean, hell, ITA bought the old Alitalia branding just to not use it, so...
That's still baffling.
At this point, like, it's all stupid stuff, I think, happening there.
Oh, man, oh, man, oh, man.
The story that keeps on giving. I'm here for it.
You just won't die. So, Betty White, Sydney Poitier, and Bob Saget, breaking news as this show is being recorded, have all passed away. And there is, as usual, an aviation angle. Seth?
Yes. Let's, A, hope that, you know, bad things happening in threes are done now for a little while. But each of the three of them has an interesting and unique little story related to aviation. 2017 is at least when Ryanair was flying to Frankfurt Real Airport. Sorry. Betty White appeared in an Air New Zealand safety video, very keen on, you know, properly buckling your seatbelt.
Mm-hmm.
Sidney Poitier has I'm sure many good scenes that have some aviation focus on them. My personal favorite, the one I'm most familiar with, is in the movie Sneakers from 1992, where he negotiates, and this is a bit of a spoiler alert if you haven't seen Sneakers, but, you know, it's worth it. It's at this point a 30-year-old movie. If you haven't seen it, it's your fault.
Too bad. Yeah, exactly.
The spoiler won't really destroy it. He negotiates two round trip first class tickets to Europe with his wife as part of a heist, and does so in a way that would impress even the most astute U.S. Airways rewards booking fiends, because he manages to include Tahiti in his trip to Europe.
What was the routing on that?
You may recall that U.S. Airways agents were renowned for manually pricing everything, and so if you could convince them an airport was in a particular part of the world, they would include it in an award. And then Bob Saget, I had a little bit of trouble just on short notice trying to find something related to him in aviation, but there's a video, and there's links to all three of these videos in the show notes for those of you who want to watch them. There's a crazy little monologue from Bob Saget about how paranoid he is to sit on the toilet in an airplane because he's convinced that it's going to suck like his spine and all of his guts out, but he'll still be able to walk and come out as like a wobbly mess.
I didn't see that on funny videos.
Yeah, not in America's Funniest Home Videos at all. It's a great little bit. Jason, I'll send it over to you so you can see it tonight. He apparently had a lot of aviation related stuff in his regular routines, which is not surprising because aviation is sort of the gift that keeps on giving when it comes to crazy experiences and comedy. So,
well, big losses to comedy and movies and acting in general. So it's sad, but good to get the aviation angle out of it, right?
Doing my best.
Yeah. I think that pretty much wraps up the regular show. We're going to talk about Air India and a little bit of seizure from them, and then some wire and tax fraud.
Can we throw one other time? I forgot to mention this to you guys, but I wanted to talk about one other thing in this show.
No, not allowed. You can't do that. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Okay, we can.
I already went off script once.
Yeah, we got a minimum of three for any given episode. Come on. I should have known this, but I'm surprised to learn that instead of windshield wipers, a bunch of private jets use hydrophobic windshield coatings.
Like,
to maintain visibility?
Like the thing on my phone, the anti-finger gunk coating?
Like Rain-X, yeah.
Oh.
Huh. But this came to light to my brain because the Dassault Falcon 6X has applied to the FAA for certification of that as a alternative to having windshield wipers. And there's, you know, specific rules about what is required in terms of how much of the windshield gets cleared, how frequently, and things like that, as, you know, at what speeds. And it was actually, reading it's interesting because the two options that typically exist and are typically certified are windshield wipers or forced air, which is basically like an additional, you know, in addition to the fact that you're flying like 150 miles across the skies or on the ground as you're rolling, there's also wind piped in that blows up the windshield to blow the water or snow out of the way. Or there's windshield wipers, but apparently neither of those work at higher speeds very well. And this hydrophobic coating seems to be much preferred, and a number of business jets use it. I was trying to figure it out, but Gulfstreams, going back at least to the G4, have used it. The G6 uses it. So going back 2007, the G4 had it approved. It's one of those interesting things that's like, you know, Embraer has on some of their private jets as well, from what I can see. G5s, G6s. Anyway, it's just a bizarre sort of interesting thing. And also, though, that makes me wonder, if it works so well on business jets, why don't they put it on commercial jets?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is the window too big for it to matter? I don't know. It was just one of those things I didn't know if you guys had ever...
Today I learned.
Do you think the FAA is going to approve it?
100%.
That is interesting. I don't know. We'd have to do some more reading on that. Like, why wouldn't commercial jets use this? Is this because they also need... it doesn't really make sense. That's a big business jet, too.
Yeah, right. Like, I mean, these aren't small planes anymore. They're getting mighty close to certainly smaller 50-seater regional jets.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, is it because of anti-ice? But that couldn't be it.
You need the same level of protection, wouldn't you?
Yeah, that's what I mean. So I don't know. That's a good question.
And we talked about the size. I actually think the 6X is too heavy to be a regional jet. Is that possible?
Yeah, it's long haul. I mean, it's big. It's a big boy.
I want to say, but right, like there's like a, for a scope clause, there's a max takeoff weight rule that the U.S. airlines have in place. And for some reason, I think when I was looking at it, I saw the weight of the plane and it was like, it was higher, heavier, max takeoff weight of 77,460 pounds, which I thought 75,000 was scope clause typical limit.
Wow. Yeah, it could be.
But, you know, it's only seats 19 people instead of 50. So.
Well, I mean, if our, any of our listeners know what's, you know, why we can't do this on commercial jets, let us know.
Yeah. Anyway, something else I thought of. Sorry.
Yeah. No, it's fine. But yeah, we're also going to talk about some wire fraud. So if you stick around, if you're a Patreon subscriber, if you'd like to become one, you can sign up. And yeah. If,
you can join a few of our more recent subscribers.
Yeah, if you want to name them, Seth.
Yeah, if I can find that tab. I was reading about other planes. Thanks, Ben, Hunter, Michael, and Sean for joining the Patreon group. You know, if you run into us at an airport, as always, track one of us down. You get a free beer out of the deal.
Yeah.
Definitely. In exchange for your contributions, plus access to the episodes early and other fun things. So
thanks to Jason for joining us. Jason, it's always fun to talk to you about aviation and trains and transport.
Oh, yeah. We should. You're an airline flyer on Twitter, right?
That's right.
Useful.
You'd think we do our research here, but
you'd think so. But I know from a fact doing my own that that's not something we
research do. The, you know, the restaurants that we're going to eat at. I don't
love restaurants, beer. But this was fun. This was a an interesting group of topics.
Why not?
Yeah.
All righty, guys. Take care.